Mark. Hey, everyone.
Good morning.
Hit that tree every week. It's good to see everyone today. Nice, beautiful weather we have. I told Rachel this morning it's green, and she's like, I feel like I'm playing some version of I Spy. She had no clue what I was talking about. I said, haven't you learned John Paulisms by this point? She goes, yeah, but you've never said that one before, so apparently I'm teaching her new things still. It's good. I'm really excited to see you all today. I'm really excited that we get to do our last miracle. How many people have sat through all seven? All right, so quite a few of you. I'm glad that you've all made it. This is the last miracle, like I just said. Before we get started, because our miracle is about raising the dead today, I want to show you how the dead trees appear to be coming back to life. So we see that a lot of people are reading their Bible. I want to see if anyone's reading any Old Testament over here. Can I see Ecclesiastes? But most of Nehemiah, all right, Isaiah, good job. I'm really impressed. I really hope that you're reading the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. It's just as important for us as Christians today. Now, one thing I heard last week that someone, in a discussion I had with someone, is this us showing off? And I don't think so. I mean, as the Bible says, the world will know us by our works. And this is just a visualization of our works. People need to be seeing us doing these works because it's who we are as Christians. We are giving new life. We have been given new life, and as such, we use that new life to share the world His message, which is, He is risen. So, with that in mind, let's get started with He Has Risen by looking at the story so far. Last week, we talked about the healing of a blind man, and the story ends with Jesus talking to some Pharisees about how they are really blind because they are guilty. And so the next chapter, chapter 10, presumably is a continuation on this discussion about their guilt. And Jesus moves here into his third and fourth I am statements by comparing himself both as the way the gates or the sheep enter and the shepherd who leads them. So we get two I am statements really, really close. And we're going to come to those in the next coming weeks. Because like I said before, I am going to be spending the next 9-10 weeks covering the seven I am statements, because it falls in the middle of Easter, so I will be taking a break to cover Easter, but we'll eventually come back to that. Then there's some more debate about whether or not Jesus is who he really says he is. Some people accuse him of having a demon, because they obviously probably think he's crazy. But at that point, he goes to the Feast of Dedication, another Jewish festival. We're learning about all the Jewish festivals in this lesson, aren't we? And the Jews again demand a clear sign of whether or not Jesus is the Christ. I don't know, I mean, what does he need? A big 20-foot billboard saying, I am the Christ? I think he's been pretty open about it. So, apparently they move beyond the fact that he's crazy to he's a heretic. And you know how they deal with heretics? Let's throw some rocks at him. When that doesn't work, they try to arrest him, but that also fails because it says he kind of passes through the crowd. And so he decides to, at this point, finally just leave Judea, go to Galilee, to the place where John is, the Baptist was baptizing, and that's where he is when we get to the current story. So the current story has to do with two sisters and a brother, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, the brother who becomes ill. Now, interestingly enough, in the beginning of this story, it tells you that Mary is the one that anoints Jesus with the perfume. Now, that in itself isn't really interesting, because most of you probably know that. But what's interesting about this is it doesn't tell you that story till chapter 12. So a little bit of foreshadowing here. But it's done that because this is probably how the events happened in this order. So Jesus is told that he's dying or he's very, very ill. But for some reason, known only to Jesus at this time, he decides to stay two extra days, and then the story goes that Lazarus dies. Everyone gets upset. Jesus ends up crying, and then he goes and he heals Lazarus by telling him to come out of the tomb while he's still wrapped in his death cloth. So that's the abridged version of the story, and I won't make the joke that apparently I made the last 7 weeks that Rachel pointed out to me last week, that's all I'm going to do. Anyway, so apparently I do repeat myself a lot. No original material. So the big thing here is there's bad news coming. Who likes bad news? Anybody here like bad news? Great, because I think if anybody raises a hand, we might have to talk. So Jesus is getting some bad news. In the story, the text says, now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, because they were from the town of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wrapped his feet with her hair. His brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. Now John is saying here, who you love. John only uses this another time to describe only one other person, and that's presumably himself. I think it's a pretty good guess it's himself. But this really is showing you the closeness of the relationship. So if one of you got a phone call from someone that you were very, very close to, about someone else that you were very, very close to, that you love very, very much, that said, this person is very, very ill, what would you do about it? You would probably make some effort to go see that person, contact that person, do whatever it is you have to do. So Jesus gets the bad news, and this is inevitably a fact in ministry. If you are serving in ministry, whether it be in the pulpit, in the mission field, or at your job, you're probably going to get some bad news. Now this is different from what we've been talking about, because that was neediness that we've been talking about in the past. This is bad news, because bad news happens. People die, people get hurt, people get sick, people get diseases, people get divorced, people get stuck, people lose their jobs, people make dumb decisions, people lose important things, or sometimes things just happen that it is beyond their control. If you need an example, please see the bulletin and the prayer list. There are plenty. Bad news happens. There's normally a proper response to bad news. Normally when you look at bad news, you try to be... sometimes it happens unexpectedly, but a lot of times we see it coming. Maybe we see someone getting sick, so and then we just watch them deteriorate to the point where we know that they're going to die. So when it happens, when we know it's going to happen, we try to prepare our body, but we can prepare our minds too. We can do it by praying or spending time in devotion or doing whatever it is that you need to do to prepare yourself for that bad news. But other times we can't really see it coming because there are a lot of things that do happen unexpectedly. Last week when we had the prayer request, I learned of three different people that had lung cancer. I know nothing about them, and the very first thing I learned about these people was they all found out they had lung cancer. And I bet it was a surprise to every single one of them, unless they were smokers, and probably not. But there are other ways that we can have that a proper response to bad news, and that is by being confident in who God is. And we should be doing that anyway, whether or not it isn't bad news, because we know who God is. We know that He is a promise keeper. We know that we are going to be with Him as Christians one day again. And so those are proper responses. And because of that, we can be confident and we can be courageous. But also, we don't have to be afraid to ask the big questions. I mean, yeah, we always say, God, I want your will to happen. But I can also say, God, it may be your will that they go home to you, but I'm still going to ask you that you heal them of their lung cancer. I'm still going to ask them that you could help them find the thing that they lost. And I will rejoice with you, but I know inside that I will feel a lot better if they are here than as opposed to if they are not. Because that's who I am. That's my nature. So I would say all of these are proper responses to bad news. But I want you to imagine something here. So we have two sisters, and we have their brother. And I think it's safe to assume that in this time period, that this brother is the provider of this family. Okay, so one sister, the two sisters are talking, they see their brother deteriorating, and so they're starting to think, okay, he's not getting better, he's getting worse. What can we do about it? What can they do about it? Hey, Mary, I have an idea. Or, sorry, probably it was the other way around. Hey, Martha, I have an idea. I know how we can fix this. Great. How can we fix this? Let's get Jesus. Oh, Mary, that's a perfect idea. Why didn't I think of that? Let's get Jesus. Because we know who Jesus is, right? We've seen and heard that Jesus healed all these other people. Surely this is cakewalk for Jesus. Let's get Jesus. Okay, so whatever they do, they send for Jesus. Jesus, I want you to come and help because the person you love, just like us, is sick. All right, so Jesus hears the news. Okay. All right, now I'm going to continue teaching. Mary, it's been a day. Where's Jesus? I don't know, Martha, but I know Jesus. I know he'll be here. Come on. I'm starting to worry, Mary. I am too, but I know Jesus. I know he will be here. Okay, it's been 2 days. Lazarus is dead. Where was Jesus? We don't know. And so this is what I can only imagine. I know Mark doesn't like speculation. Where is Mark? But I have to imagine this is almost exactly how it plays out. Because there's really not many other choices on how this could have played out. So Jesus tells us, ask and you will receive. And I have to know that at this point, at this moment, both of these sisters are thinking, I asked and you weren't there. Because that is the exact response both sisters are going to give Jesus. I asked and you were not there. They expected Jesus to be there because he is their friend. And probably much more of that. He probably considered them to be family. Jesus' response is not what you would expect. Now we see that Jesus did all these other things to people he did not know. He was still willing to go, willing to heal them. But this is his friend, his close friend, the person he loved, and he waited. As it says in verse 5 and 6. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed for 2 days longer than in the place that he was. Wait, I would not have expected Jesus to do this. Reading this story the very first time, I would have thought, I don't know, it was a long time ago, the last time I read this story the first time I ever read this story. I would have thought that Jesus would have went right away. I did not expect him to wait. Jesus is always doing these things I don't expect him to do. I don't expect Jesus to turn water into wine. It kind of rubs me the wrong way. Jesus is this guy that's described as love, the epitome of love. I don't expect that my Jesus, the Jesus that I know him, to go into the temple and overturn tables. I don't expect Jesus... As a Jew, well, this is a little lost on me, but it would not have been lost on his disciples to talk to Samaritans, especially a Samaritan woman. I wouldn't have expected him to tell the crowd to stone the woman. I would not have, especially not that one. My Jesus would never have said that, but he did say that. But he also said that only if you're sinless. See, I have this idea in my head of what Jesus is, and Jesus is constantly proving to me that he's not that. And he's constantly proving to the people around them that he is not that. That is not who Jesus is. And so Jesus, and I should have added my name to this list, is Jesus is often doing things that make those around him or make those that love him uncomfortable. Does Jesus make you uncomfortable? Does he? He should. So we see these groups of people. We see the disciples are being made uncomfortable by Jesus. And this shows up in verse 8, chapter 11. The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you are going there again?" They know why Jesus isn't there right now. They heard the news. They're like, okay, well, we understand this relationship, but we also know that they're trying to kill him. And he can't go back to Judea. Bethany is like, what, a few miles from Jerusalem? It's really close. And they know he cannot go back there because they will kill him. So when he says they're going to go back there, they're questioning him about it. Wait, are you sure about that? We know something's going to happen if you go back there. And even further, in the story, it says that they thought that it was unnecessary for him to go because he was talking in words that they did not understand. He had fallen asleep. Oh, maybe he's recovering. Why do you need to go there? Martha. Martha's response shows that Jesus has made her uncomfortable. Verse 21, Martha says to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." How do you read that and not see resentment? And her other responses aren't much better. "But even now I know that whether you ask from God, God will give you. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." This is appeasement. This is expectation. But this is obviously not what she wanted. I know that when someone dies, if they're a Christian, I get to see them again. But if I love them, I don't want them dead. I want them standing right here next to me. So I think what Martha is doing in these second two verses is she is paying lip service, but she is still grieving. And she is still mad that Jesus was not there. And Mary, same thing, verse 32, "Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died." And Mary's supposed to be the good one. But how do you read this and not see anger, frustration, resentment, sadness, bitterness? How do you not have someone taken from you and not feel those things despite the fact that they are now going to heaven? Isn't that difficult? The reality is, and I hate this, I absolutely hate this, because I feel like it rubs me and people the wrong way, that the Lord allows those he loves to suffer. There's no promise of prosperity. This is why I don't like Joel Osteen. Joel Osteen makes it sound like that if you follow God, you will get prosperity. But there's no promise of that at all. And this is a perfect example of that. But also, John emphasizes two things in this chapter. The first one, he emphasizes the relationship. Like I said, those he loved. Jesus loved these people. But he spends the next 11 verses talking about why Jesus waited. Why would he do that? Why would Jesus do that? When you have this delay, if you told someone you loved them and they waited 2 days, if you told someone that loved you that someone else was dying or that you were dying and they waited 2 days to get back to you, would you feel like that was love? Probably no. You would feel like that was apathy. Like they didn't care at all. Even more frustrating is in this relationship, in this line of what is happening right now, is often, and maybe almost always, we cannot, may not, or will not know the reason why we are suffering. Now, Jesus says in verse 4, it is lucky lucky that he wasn't there, because they get to use this opportunity for God and the Son of God to be glorified. But this is essentially the second message of Job. See, Job would be a very, very different book for us if we didn't have chapters 1 and 2. But the second message of Job is Job doesn't know why he's suffering. And he never finds out why he's suffering. But he does figure out what's more important. So if you read Job's final response, this is Job's final response to God. I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Job spent 7 chapters arguing with God. And he finally figures it out in the last part. I just didn't understand. And this is part of what that is we just don't understand. Maybe because we don't know. But God definitely does know. Hear and I will speak. I will question you and I will make and you will make it known to me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself, and the most important part, I repent in dust and ashes. Because I argued out of frustration. And that was wrong. And he sees that maybe he does not know, but he does know that he was wrong. But also, love requires delay. Sometimes love does require delay. And that may not be understood in our time frame, or our timeline, or by our own, or in our own time. Because God does not operate in our time. As we see, both Mary and Martha say, Lord, if you had been there. Jesus didn't need to be there. John already proved in his miracles that Jesus did not have to be there to save Lazarus. Because he already saved someone else. He saved the child. Was he there for the child? Not physically. But he still healed the child. He did not need to be there. And so when I read this, I think of something. He was there at just the right time. And finally, Christ emphasizes, sympathizes, and suffers with us, but is also moved by us. So he sees the crowd, he sees the people, and he sees that they are suffering. And because of that, he is moved by compassion. But he is also moved because he lost a friend. And that causes him to cry. So we get to see the humanity of Jesus. That he really did care about it. Maybe he didn't want it to play out this way. I don't know. I'm not going to speculate about that. But he did it exactly this way because it was the way it had to be done. And that makes us uncomfortable. Maybe it even made him uncomfortable. But it was done at just the right time. For just the right reasons. And I really want to emphasize that. Just the right time. For just the right reasons. Because as Paul writes in Romans, for while we were still weak, at just the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. We don't understand. If I comprehend anything about God, it is less than the size of an atom compared to the whole universe. I don't understand God. But I know He understands me. I know He understands us. And I know He understands the big plan. And He does things at just the right time. But more importantly, I also know that God does these things for a purpose. And we are called to that purpose of who He is. And what it means to be a child of God. And if that's something that we or the elders can show you, or if you find that you need help from the church, we invite you to respond to this message.